Algorithm developer at the Telos Alliance. He is known for his algorithm work in the Omni 11 audio processor and has recently spent lots of time working with the Volterra Audio Watermark Enhancer. Cornelius' background in audio processing began as a teenager. His first complete audio processor, the Audio Chameleon, debuted on the Cleveland airwaves in 1992 on college station WJCU. Gould has 19 years of broadcast engineering experience. Please welcome Cornelius Gould.
Hello, and thanks for showing up for the presentation here. I'm Cornelius Gould, the senior algorithm developer for the Telos Alliance and working specifically with Omnia Audio and nowadays 25/7. The 25/7 team, when they came in to the organization, approached me shortly after the Volterra was introduced to pick my brain, as it were, on ways to find out how to take the Volterra and its usefulness to another level and integrate it with audio processing in some way. So I very excitedly got involved with that, and you'll see why as we move forward here. So we're going to be talking about basically the intersection of audio processing and the rating system. And also integrating the Volterra with the audio processing. We found different ways you can integrate the Volterra into your audio processing chain to actually assist in its activities, as well as assist in the watermark's performance, improving that. And we will show examples of using the Volterra as an advanced watermark monitor, which in this case here is its main role in the task that I have been using it. So first we're going to do a quick overview of what is going on with the ratings watermarking system. And basically what ends up happening today is if you're in the market with the watermark ratings technology in use and you've got the equipment on the air, basically what you end up with is two different audiences. You have the audiences of humans who all decided to tune into your station and enjoy your content. And piggybacking along with some of these people are the portable meters. And each one is listening to a different channel. The human audience, they are listening to the material that you and your program directors have all prepared and you've adjusted the processing just so to try to attract the listeners. They come along. And then you have the watermark encoders, the watermark detectors that are listening for these watermark tones that are in your signal and embedded into your audio. And they basically log your station ID and your what time they heard the ID. And this is important, because without that going out, the humans might as well not be there. So how do we make this work? Well, it's all in hiding the tones in your audio. And the example I give for this every time I talk about it, this is something actually I created years ago when talking about how codecs work, lossy codecs. And I've adapted this to talk about the watermark encoding because it's kind of the opposite of that. If I were to have a rock and a pin and I drop them on the table at the same time, which sound would you hear? If they hit the table at the same time, which sound would you hear? The rock, yes. The pinned audio is there, but because of the quirks in how our hearing works, the sound of the rock would mask out the sound of the pin. Electronically, you'll be able to detect both, but people won't hear it. And that's because we're temporarily deaf to smaller sounds that happen slightly before and after a loud sound happens. So perceptual codecs such as MP3 and all, they take advantage of that because they can remove things from around these louder sounds and louder tones without you realizing something's gone. And the watermarking system does the opposite of that. So let's take a closer look at this. Another way to look at that same example is if this big massive area here is the sound of the rock, the sound of the pin would hide somewhere underneath of this red area here, which you can think of as sort of like either a blanket or a quilt. If you lay it on top of that louder sound, what you get is this area underneath of the quilt that could be used to, in this case, stick things in without you noticing that they're there. So the watermark encoder will stick the tones around these loud sounds. As long as they don't poke through the boundary of this blanket, you wouldn't hear it. So that's kind of the game they're playing. Now, my first thing I'm going to point out here, and this is very important because part of what we're talking about is where is the best place to put the watermark encoder in your air chain. And the very first implication here, and I alluded to this earlier, the codecs are trying to do the opposite, lossy codecs. So they're trying to remove things underneath this blanket here while the watermark encoder is trying to stick things into this blanket. So the very first thing I would say, and that we are in the process of researching, and the first piece of advice we've been able to confirm on so far, is that you definitely do not want this in front of a lossy STL system, because the two are going to fight for this space under here. And some codecs, we saw that you can get the tones through. Others, there's just so much quantization noise under this blanket that it's just a mess, and there's nothing to decode tone-wise. So that's the first piece of advice for you as far as where to place these in the air chain. Now, what is the watermarking system? The watermarking system consists of 10 different tones between 1 and 3 kilohertz. And the data message is frequency shift keyed under those tones. And those tones are kind of modulated by your program content. So they're sort of opportunistic. If there's enough material content to cover up the fact that the tones are there, and that material sitting near any one of these frequencies, the system will turn on the appropriate bands between 1 and 3 kilohertz to send that data through. So that's the trick that it's trying to do. And on that message, the payload that's on there is basically 10 channels of redundant data. So you've got a time code that goes out, and in these, which consists of these 4 symbols here. And the rest of the symbols that are sent out are basically your station identification. And it takes 4.8 seconds for this to go through. Each symbol is about 400 milliseconds to get the message through from each symbol. And it's redundant. It's highly redundant. There's 10 different channels. They all carry the same thing. And it's just a matter of if the system is able to send all 10 tones down the pike at the same time, it will do that. Then you've got all this built-in redundancy. And if you do have robust material going on or whatever, you can lose up to about 99% of those symbols and still get an accurate read at the other end. And that's kind of what the hope was on the system when it was designed, that this level of redundancy would cover just about every contingency that you can have programming-wise. And it certainly would seem like that on the surface, but we've run into material that both broadcasters have identified, and then we confirmed that kind of breaks the system, and we'll get into that too. Here's another way of looking at that spectrum here. What we have here is basically a very dense audio sample here, where we take a waterfall print of what's going out the tones. And in that tone region, you see there's enough energy here that if you were to lay a blanket or a quilt over top of all of this here, you'll find there's plenty of spaces that the system can inject tones under. And in a situation like this, it'll be no problem decoding anything with the watermark system. Now, there's something that's more typical of what a lot of the program content that we have out there, this will resemble that. I kind of started kind of odd in that, but most of your program content is going to resemble this. And this will decode just fine as well, because although there's the activity down in this in the upper frequencies areas is kind of light, you do have more robust activity going on in the lower channels, and you do have complete IDs going out consistently every 4.8 seconds. So this will decode just fine in the real world of the watermark. Now we get into some material, such as speech, certain music formats, where the nature of the material is very sporadic and very staccato-like. And when you have that happening, first of all, there's, you know, it's something like an example of like speech or hip hop or something like that. There's very little energy that really appears in the upper bands, and when it is there, it's very brief in nature. So you end up with something like this, like a sparse frequency, time frequency mapping here, were the lowest bands possible that's closest to the fundamentals of the program content are turned on, but they're on for very short periods of time. And especially if you don't have enough time to get any of those symbols through, like each symbol takes about 400 milliseconds in time. And if you think about a lot of these formats like speech or like the dancey hip hop type music formats, there's very little that actually happens in any one of those bands that lasts that long. It's usually some fraction of that period of time. And if it's sparse enough in time, the tones are on and off so fast that they don't even resemble a tone, so you can't even get any data recovered from that. So this is the area that we've concentrated on, both with my work with processing and with the Voltaire team, to how do we improve this situation here. So now let's start to go a little bit further into the big picture of things as we start to build up the story here. The environment at the watermark, we're going to come back to this picture again, but I'm going to address right now with the area I concentrated mostly on here is this area within your radio station in this environment, between your microphone and your antenna. This area is something that all the broadcasters in the watermarking world have full control over. So my goal was to figure out ways to make sure that by the time your signal reaches this antenna, I want to make sure that you've got your station ID going out on the watermark as often as possible so that you stand a better chance of overcoming all the real world, you know, things that you don't have control over that could possibly interfere with the successful decoding of your station ID. So we're going to delve deeper into this here. So, people have come to me when the whole system was first rolled out and asked me questions like, if I were to take my audio processor and if I were to equalize this band right here, because I heard they're in these frequency bands, 1 to 3K, right? What if I turn that up going into the audio processor? Would that help decode things? And my answer was like, yeah, well, maybe, maybe not. Well, but what about if I put some extra gain riding in there? What if I do this? So there's all these ideas and all these things I've heard people do, and I've even heard radio stations where they've taken this one piece of information of 1 to 3K and they decide they're going to just boost it. And there's so many radio stations that have that band boosted thinking that they're going to help the tones come through. And we're going to get into a smart way. The people who approached me with this with audio processor were onto something. Yes, processing could help you, but without the right tools, it's kind of hard to know where to go or if you're even making progress. So first of all, what we're going to do is we're going to look at how the watermark encoder is currently placed in the chain in the recommended positions. Now, if anybody who has the watermarking encoders and look through the manuals, you'll see a little section in there where they talk about the optimum place to put the watermark encoders. For AM, they suggest placing it after your main audio processor, but before your transmitter. And the idea being that the normalization of your program content that the AM processor will do will help the watermark encoder encode better going to the transmitter. That is the first clue right there for people. But the problem that you run into here is that after the watermark encoder, there's nothing else there processing-wise. So you can be adding these tones on, and they can be added in very robustly there, I might say. But what ends up happening is with that tight peak control coming out of the transmitter, you have tiny little overshoots that are the watermark tones riding on top of everything. Now, if you're on a station that's not really in a competitive environment, and you're just kind of like, okay, well, we do light processing anyway, it doesn't really matter, it could work. But if you're in a tight battle on a news talk where every dB of loudness is precious, you can't afford to go backing down on your modulation to fit those watermark tones in. So that's one downside there. So a lot of AM stations would just use the same chain that the FM use. And the FM, what's suggested is that you place the watermark encoder after some type of a preprocessor AGC, but before your main audio processing. And that's that came out of a practical reason, because the FM band, the output of your audio processor going to the transmitter, has encoded stereo on it, and it's got preemphasis and just things that you just can't put the watermark encoder there. And because of all of that, if you did stick the watermark encoder on the output of your processor, then the tiny overshoots that would normally be there would be magnified by preemphasis, and that just gets messy. So it's just easier to just stick it here and be done with it. So most people would stick a wideband device of some kind there, like a compeller or whatever, to gain ride the program content. And the reason you want to do that is because the program levels are important. They're very critical. I've done a few tests with a few broadcasters just to see what the effect is here. And some stations that are in the position where they can do this for a short period of time ran without any gain riding in front of the watermark encoder and then put it back in. And what they found is if they had a board operator that decided to put a program on the air, and then the program started and they walk off to make themselves their bag of popcorn in the microwave down in the lunchroom or whatever, and leave the studio going with the levels really low on the board, and it runs like that for a while until the board operator comes back and goes, oh, the levels are too low, and turn it back up. What they've noticed is they saw it in the ratings. They saw they had no ratings until the guy turned the board up. So gain riding levels are important. Now, as I go further into this here, I'm going to focus in on content that's hard to encode. And that's an important thing here, because most of your formats that do well right now in the watermark ratings world, generally are things that are going to encode just fine. And you can do very little to screw it up. You can take your processor and dial it all kinds of different ways, and you probably will not see much of an impact at all in your ratings. But if you're broadcasting something that's very tricky in content and very hard to stick a watermark to, then what you do to the processing and the things around the watermark encoder makes a big difference. And the first thing I would like to point out is this wideband gain controller. Now, one of the hallmarks of some of the formats that are hard to encode is that they just happen to have a lot of bass in there. And what ends up happening is that the bass ends up dominating the control action of the gain writing device. Now, I'm going to bring up this old picture here that any of us that have been around for a while have seen this off and on, especially when it comes time with audio processing, and this is the Fletcher-Munson curve. And this is the sensitivity of the human hearing to frequencies. This is important to keep in mind because at normal listening levels, which are like at comfortable listening levels, we need a big boost at low frequencies at the bass for the audio to sound right, which is why you have the loudness button on your radio. And the similar thing happens with the highs, but not as much as the lows. Well, a lot of the material, the music that is produced out there is produced with the idea that you're listening at some lower level and that you're not cranking it all the way up. And if you crank it up all the way, by the way, then that this curve starts to flatten out where you become equally sensitive to all frequencies, but that's pretty loud. So everything is already produced kind of with this boost going on anyway that all the electronic gear sees, but we don't hear it that way. It just sounds normal to us. Then you take something where they're emphasizing the bass, such as the hip-hop and all that, then this boost is even more extreme. And what ends up happening is that this area back here is what's controlling the gain control device. And you can see down in here, this is where the watermarking tones will live, and that's the gain control devices see very little of that. So as the bass energy increases up here, all of the key frequencies that the encoder needs to work with get pushed further down in the mud, level-wise. So that's the first thing right there. So with this in mind, people have gone to figuring out, well, what if I put like multi-band AGC, like Ariane or whatever in front? And what you would see is, yes, you can probably make an improvement and it looks great at that point. And in this case now, as I'm moving to this slide here, which is a typical audio processing chain, just keep in mind that in this case, your watermark encoder, the AGC, or multiband AGC, or whatever games you're playing up here to make the watermark encoder look fine, they're all ahead, and then it feeds into your main audio processing. And this is where the maybe answer I give people comes in, because they're playing games in front of the audio processor, but the job that the audio processor does is to normalize your program content. So if you're pushing this frequency up, the processor is going to be pulling it back down. So you may end up with something that looks great on the front end, but by the time it comes out the back end here, you're either back to where you were before or whatever. You just don't know what's going on. And plus, you've got all kinds of other things going on within the audio processor, like phase rotating and filtering and all kinds of crazy things that these boxes do to create loudness, and none of it's visible to you. So with that in mind, I'm going to point out something that just make it obvious here, make it even more obvious. And this is the answer, a charge that people level with us because we have the Voltaire unit. And if you're using the Voltaire to enhance the watermark tones, which we'll get into a little bit on that in a second, the claim is that you're manipulating the tones, you're messing with things, and the tones could be bent out of perspective. And the point I want to make is that whenever you have that watermarking equipment in front of a main audio processor, especially a multiband one, the tones are getting manipulated anyway. They may not be manipulated in a way that's helping you, but they're being manipulated. So in this example here, starting with the front end of one of our processors here, anytime the wideband gain stage has to make an adjustment because the program content is too loud or too little, anytime that band moves around, it's also bringing the tones up and down with it. Likewise, on a multiband stage, it gets to be even more severe. And I have the arrow pointing at the one band in the audio processor where the tones which will come through, which happens to cover that area. Anytime this particular band moves up and down to re-equalize your program content, it's bringing the tones up and down with it. And likely with the limiter, in this case, this band here is the one that happens to be 1 to 3K. Now, we didn't design that with PPM in mind. We've used this structure for a while, but it just happens to be how the things played out now. So anytime this band is moving up and down for, you know, the control audio going into the clipper, you're manipulating the tones. So you've got three stages here that are manipulating the watermarking tones, assuming you're not also playing games in front of the audio processor too. So this is already going on. The tones are being manipulated big time just with chains the way they are today. What I'm here to do is try and give you some control over this process, this tame, this down some. So with that thought in mind, Frank Foti and I, we did an experiment with some broadcasters in Frank's office one December a couple years ago, where I was sitting there with my computer and the Omni 11 code, and they had a watermark encoder, and they were able to extract tones out of the soup of audio. And they had me writing the code and moving this little patch point, as we call it, around in the chain of the processor until we found a point where the tones look nice and robust. And we figured, okay, this is it. So out of that work became the insert point or the patch point that you know of right now if you're using an Omni 11 processor. And people are starting to implement the watermark encoder and Voltaire into this insert point now. The problem we had at the time, when we released this and people put their watermark encoders, which in effect, by the way, is placing it downstream of all the bulk of the processing that's going on. So you're taking advantage of the normalization that's going on. All the audio's already gone through crossovers and filters and everything, and you're just presenting the normalized output to the watermark encoder. So this is very much like what you get with the AM station, except the final stages with control the peak, that all the peak levels so that you don't overmodulate by having it there. So anyway, when we did this and people started to use it with just a barefoot watermark encoder, the comments we got back were very bipolar. It's either, hey, this is the greatest thing ever. My station suddenly showed up in the books and you guys are like wonderful. I'm never pulling this out again. It's great. We had other people that's like, well, we put it in, but nothing changed. And you guys said that it could change stuff, what's going on. And we were like, well, technically it should work, but you know, we didn't have any visibility into this. So what was needed? Well, we all have monitors for everything in radio, and you know, this happens to be a modulation meter, and I know there's people who know program directors who would love for that needle to stand just like that, no matter what's playing on the air, but you know, whatever. But anyway, but we needed some way to really know what's going on. And so when the Voltaire team came to me and said, hey, you know, we've got this Voltaire here, we want you to play with it, I was like, yippee, this is what we needed. This could answer the questions that we had. So enter the Voltaire. And we're going to talk about this really quick because the point I'm emphasizing here is the monitoring capabilities of the Voltaire. So we're going to take a quick look at what's on the screen here. How many of you are familiar with the Voltaire product? I guess we have a handful of people. How many have heard of it but have no clue and want to know? Okay, so we can go in some detail. So basically, when it comes to a monitor, when you have the watermark system installed in the station right now, the confidence monitor that you get has an LED on the front. It's either red or green. And a lot of people came to us saying, there's more to this story, because you can pull the audio from this box and it stays green for several minutes. What's the story with this? And we kind of had, well, it must be some buffering in there or whatever. And people, no, because of, you know, I've got this situation and we want you to guys look at, there's something going on. I should have more ratings than this. What's happening? So out of all these investigations, not only did we find out what was happening, but we also were able to design a better confidence monitor. So that's what you get here on this section of the screen here with these two rows of green bars here. The top row here is what's going on with the watermark encoder without any Voltaire enhancement whatsoever, and the bottom row is with Voltaire enhancement. Basically, each one of these bars represents 1 minute of activity, and if the Voltaire is able to recover your station ID on a regular basis during that 1 minute period, it would paint a green bar there. And the more successful it is at recovering that data, the darker the green bar is and the taller it is. Now, in this case here, you see a couple of red ones. And then during that minute of programming, it wasn't able to assemble enough of the station ID out of the programming audio to have any confidence that your ID got out to the listeners. So it paints a red one there. And as you can see, after the Voltaire enhancements there, you see that, okay, that red spot is now yellow. And the green ones are even taller, and the yellow ones are nice and green. This is after the Voltaire has enhanced the audio, the watermarking signal. And part of what's going on here is that when you have difficult to encode material, like I said earlier, the tone is on and off in this really short period of time, and it's usually not enough time to get a complete message through. So one of the tricks that the Voltaire does to the watermarking is it tries to get the watermark encoder to send the tones out just a little bit longer, just a little longer. Let's get a little more of this message through. And sometimes that's all it takes. You know, since the system is very redundant, if you get a little bit of data here at this moment and a little bit of data at that moment, this little bit of data here, over that 1 minute period, the edit rules in the ratings company can reassemble what your ID is supposed to be, and then you get credit. So the idea is to get as much of these fragments out there as possible on this difficult to encode material. And that's what the Voltaire is showing you. It's doing a simulation of the edit rules that happened back at the plant, to the best of our knowledge. Now, this seems to correspond very closely to what people get back from the raw and meter data, so that means that, you know, the guys that researched this at 25.7 must have gotten something right, because it corresponds with that very closely. Let's see here, anything else to run through? Okay, so you have also an enhancement level here where there's a user control. We can adjust how aggressive the Voltaire is going to be at, you know, processing the watermark tones. You go too far, you hear it. And that's one of the things you get people saying that, you know, they criticize Voltaire because it ruins audio and you can't, you know, oh, I listen to all these stations and I can hear it going. And the thing that's going on with that is you've got a few groups out there who are, from a top level management level on down, have dictated to stations that they're going to use a level on the Voltaire, and it's usually some really high number like 20. And the entire chain has to run with this level or you're fired kind of thing. So they have to crank them up. Now, that's equivalent to telling every radio station in your chain that they're going to use the nuclear preset regardless of your format. So of course, when you do that, most of your chain is going to sound like crap anyway. So there's a reason why we give you controls and other options and presets so that you can match up the sound of the processor to your format. And having enhancement control in the Voltaire allows you to do that. Some formats don't need a lot of enhancement. You can turn it down. Some of them need more. But if you need more and you turn them up, you really can get to the point where you might start to hear it a little bit, but not as bad as some places, especially on music formats, because there's a lot of music formats that just have it way too high. The other control we give you is an environment control, where you can select an environment and an environment level. And when you do that, basically what you turn this display into is a virtual panelist. And you can put that panelist, in this case they're in a car, a vehicle, with their noise level at minus 15. You can place them in a kitchen, you can place them in a bar. There's different environments we can dial in there. So if you have an idea of where most of your listeners are listening to the station, you can design the environment in here. And I'll show you in a little bit here that the second you dial that in, you'll see the confidence levels change, usually dropping down and becomes more realistic. And stations have used that to match up what's on this display, to using this display and the environment adjustment, they're able to set it up so that what's on the display actually ends up matching pretty closely to what they're getting back on the raw meter data. So it's a very useful tool. Like I said, it's a very advanced confidence monitor, and it's very useful. Okay, so as I kind of pointed out by talking ahead a little bit, the environment control is designed to kind of provide this picture so you get some idea of what's going on in the real world between the radio that's playing your station, it's got the tones on it, and the meter that's listening for the tones. All right, so in this case here, I have two different examples using some material that's, you know, not too bad to encode. And here I have no environment dialed in this, you know, nice long period of time here, about 40 minutes of audio, where without any environment dialed in, everything looks great, and the Voltaire says, look at this, you are golden here. But as soon as you dial in some environment, in this case that vehicle, the car at minus 15, you see that the confidence drops down a little bit because now you're providing the interference of a real world situation here, and you can see the levels drop. And you can see that the Voltaire is able to compensate for that by bringing it back up. So when you look at the next few examples here, this is what you're going to be seeing here as we go around. So now to my part of this whole experiment here. Where is a good place to put it? And I was able to revisit this and had a lot of fun doing it. Well, it wasn't really a lot of fun. It was very frustrating because first you have to find something that's, you know, that's consistently bad, and it's not as easy as it seems. So by the time I found something, then it was fun, and I can move things around and see where I can make a difference. So most stations using the watermark encoder, either barefoot or with the Voltaire, have it in front of the audio processing, again, with something sitting ahead of this, typically like an AGC or something. And right now you can say with confidence that, yes, the audio looks great, the Voltaire tells me I'm golden, and it feeds in all this, and then you don't know what happens after that. You just kind of hope that that what it's showing you here is true by the time it gets to this side of the processor. So I experiment with moving here, and I've seen that it not only makes a difference, but you can also use the processor to help out the Voltaire so that you don't have to use as much enhancement on the Voltaire in many cases as you would with it sitting outside your audio processing. So here is an example using some tricky to encode material, and I have no environment going at all. And I have the encoder in front here, and you're basically seeing what's at the program line here. And with no environment dialed in, you see that there's some tricky moments of red, of course, and then you get the green out of the Voltaire, kind of what we're expecting when we see this. Now, when we move it to the insert point in the processor, again, with no environment, we can see that out of the watermark encoder, barefoot, it's actually doing a much better job sticking a watermark to it with only a couple of red spots in here. And then after the Voltaire gets done with it, it's pulling it way up. So again, this is without any environment dialed in. This will be a true scenario if someone's sitting in a quiet room with no other interference around. Now, if we dial in some environment with the watermark encoder in front of the audio processor, we see the confidence on this tricky material, which this in this case is kind of like the hip-hop stuff with very little going on. We see the confidence drops down into the mud, which is basically what we've been seeing from broadcasters that are doing broadcasting these types of formats, wondering where do our audience go? Well, the tones just weren't getting through. And the Voltaire isn't really able to help much except for a moment here and a moment there. Technically, all it takes is for a single moment in time during a quarter hour period for you to get credit. And so that's kind of what people would cross their fingers and pray that, you know, that moment happened, or they may say, well, we got credit there. From my point of view, being a former broadcast engineer, that's not good enough, because in my book, I'd say, well, what if half of my audience was in a spot where they got this good and the other half was fumbling through a purse or something when that one moment in time happened for an ID, and you just lost that golden moment because there's no other good moments after that. So that's where I went crazy. We got to make this better. So using the audio processing, by moving the watermark encoder and the Voltaire into the insert point, I was able to make changes to the processing in such a way where the Voltaire was able to actually take this and stretch the watermark just enough where this sea of red with the environment turned and turn into green. Interestingly enough, the watermark encoder by itself didn't really change all that much. You see that the red levels you know, kind of evened out a little bit, but not as much as when the Voltaire got a hold of it. Basically what you end up doing here is when I adjusted the processing here with the programming content, one of the jobs that an audio processor does to create loudness is that it kind of compresses waveforms down. So if you've got tall, spiky, narrow, peaky material coming in, by the time you run it through an audio processor, it's going to smash it down and it's going to get a little fatter. So that basically increases the duty cycle of that audio that's going into the watermark encoder. So my feeling is, that since we don't really have a lot of information for sure what's going on in the watermark encoder, with that in mind, I think what ended up happening is that the waveform stretched out just enough where there were partial IDs getting through. And then the Voltaire, by its nature of trying to get the watermark tones to stay on just a little bit longer, that combination caused it to keep them on long enough to actually get some IDs through, to get some complete IDs through on that content. So that was the aha moment for me, and I was able to replicate that over and over again with the difficult encode material. So if we compare the two side by side here, we see that, you know, you can see this is with the Voltaire and watermark encoder sitting in front of the audio processing. This is using your audio processing chain to assist the Voltaire in getting some difficult encode material through. Another area that we're in the middle of working with now is I've got a few talk stations that are working with this on their talk formats, and it's really early yet. We put it on the air, and we had about an hour of looking at the Voltaire before I ran out of the shack, the transmitter shack, to get, you know, back to the office. And then I've been on the road ever since. But that short hour of time, the engineers went, wow, that looks a lot better. And I'm looking at the green, and since I'm not there all the time, I don't know what a lot better means. But I did see a lot of green there on the talk show for the first time. Meaning that when I was there earlier, I did see a lot of reds going on and while I was preparing the software and loading things in. And afterwards, it seemed to me that there was a lot of green, but, you know, being the person hoping that it works, that could be wishful thinking, but they agreed that it looked a lot better. So when I get back, I'll be able to see what things look like after a two-week period and see if we made some headway. But that's the next area I'm starting to dabble into is actually seeing what we can do to help talk radio. So some conclusions here to take away from this. The location of your watermark encoder and program level consistency is a main factor for making sure that you are able to get your station IDs out using the watermark system on a consistent basis. Be careful of using lossy STLs after the watermark encoder. There's some things that we're starting to see that even having some lossy codec stuff in, you know, ahead of the watermark encoder can cause problems. And we suspect that that's because some of the processes of, depending on how deep you're cutting into the bit, the audio with a lossy codec, if you're using a really low bit rate or being really aggressive about it, the area that's cleared out, we think, is becoming noisy with quantization noise, and that can interfere with the tones and the watermark's receiver's ability to extract the tones out of the signal. So lossy codec stuff is kind of a touchy subject right now that we're starting to look into. You definitely need a monitor in today's day, especially in these ratings, because without the ratings, you don't exist on the dial. And having a monitor to make you aware of what's going on with that watermark and being able to tweak your processing to make sure that not only does it sound good for your listeners, but your settings are compatible with the watermark encoding and your programming is important. So that goes along with your signature sound. And this insertion scheme is something that's new. It's coming out in the Omnia 9 software soon, and the Omnia 11 software is in its bug testing phase right now, and then once we get past all that and unleash it to the world, you'll have the Omnia 11 with the new insert point that was designed with this work here in mind. So with that, we've got some time for questions, and thanks you for listening so far. All right, we've got questions. Okay.
Okay. Is this the same scheme that's used in television? And is there a way to monitor how that is performing?
I think television, it has a different system. This came out, while it's all under Nielsen, Nielsen's had its system that it's been using for a while, and this came from Arbitron before they all merged together. And this technology actually is kind of old. It was... By today's standards, you can do things a lot better, but if you think back on the process that it took them, they had to go through a lot of approval hurdles with a lot of oversight from broadcasters. And by the time they finally hit to the market, it was already kind of old. And that was about, what, 10 years ago or so? So 10 years have passed since then. So, and the TV system, I hear, is a bit better because I think they're using spread spectrum stuff on TV for that. And with TV, you can actually inject it a little hotter. And you can kind of hear it on your sub, like I would hear it on the surround channels on some things. I was wondering, what the heck is that? But most people don't notice it because they're concentrating on the picture. So you've got the advantage where you can jack them in a little hotter on TV, too. So,
I'm over here.
Okay, yes.
What sort of artifact would you expect to hear in the audio if you overly enhanced it with the Voltaire?
Well, what you'll get is it could sound any number of ways. You could either sound like really hollow. It may sound like your audio is playing through a trash can, or sometimes it might sound distorted. It just depends on how it interacts with the program content when you get it too high. If it's up that high, then the problem you run into is if you inject it like too much, it'll work great for the meters, but it'll drive the people away. So if we were just broadcasting for the meters, we'd just broadcast PPM tones all day and all night, and then it'll be perfect. But you want the people to stick around, so we give you that control so you can make that trade-off. So once you start to hear it, it's probably too much. So you want to back it down. The idea is that you're not supposed to hear the tones. So,
I have a question over here.
Yes.
Over here. Hi.
Ah, there you are. I'm getting disoriented because the voices are coming out of the speaker in front of me. Okay.
Has any case study been done on HD so far, considering it's an extremely aggressive codec and we know it damages things?
Actually, a few folks have messed around with that, and there is a mode in particular that I think Frank hit on that was looking kind of suspicious. But right now, we will keep investigating that. I don't know for sure, and it's been just like an initial look-see into this whole thing, and there's things there. I don't want to get too deep into that because there's people that are thinking of ways around that right now, and they're talking with us, so it may not be as dire as it seems right now. So, okay.
Yes, I was going to ask, until the insert schemes are ready, mm-hmm. is it still best to place it between your AGC and your final processing? Is that where we need to reside now?
That's better than not having anything in front of it. If you have an 11 right now, the current scheme that's in there is after the multiband processing, so that's kind of good because then you don't have to have other boxes hanging around in front of it. So that'll help you as well. So this scheme here allows you to take advantage of all the stages in the processing to assist on difficult to encode material. So it's kind of the ultimate. But right now, anything writing the levels and making it somewhat more consistent than raw program is a good thing. So,
okay.
Can you explain a little bit more on the environmental level? Mm-hmm. The low end being a nice quiet room, what's the high end, like Lambeau Field during a football game? Or?
Yeah, that could be a high one. What you can do is, on the environment, you can simulate all of that by turning up the levels around this virtual panelist. And you'll see the higher you make it, the more the confidence drops.
But what are we basing it on? What's the high end? A tornado or?
Oh, it's basically, you're mixing in this audio at.
That meter goes from what, 0 to 24?
Well, the meter on the.
Or the dial, the adjustment?
It goes from minus 24 dB to 0 dB.
Right.
At 0 dB, the noise is just as loud as your content.
Okay, so 0 is way down at the.
Yeah, 0 is incredibly loud.
All right.
And the way I recommend is you can get some idea of where you should set it if you have a car and you can do a sound level measurement and you know, base that. Basically find out what your signal to noise ratio is between the audio on the receiver and the noise in the car, and that's where you set the environment level.
Okay.
On your representation of what the tones recovery looks like after the environment, is that a prediction made by the Voltaire, or do you have some way that you can actually feed your RF signal into it and see what it looks like after it's modulated and demodulated?
Okay, right now, feeding the RF signal in after it's modulated and demodulated is not that much different than where it's sitting when it's at the back end of the processor. It's sort of the same thing. But What the environment does is that it tries to add in to the picture that element that you're not in control of. So that's the one thing that we can't really mix in the radio station no matter what, and that's the room noise or the noises in the cars or the noises in the kitchen or the noises in the restaurant that could be happening between the speaker playing the station and the meter on the person's hip. So that's what the environment is simulating, just this real world noises that your listeners are in every moment of the day, unless they're laying in the bed somewhere. If you've got a follow-up question, go ahead and ask if I didn't quite answer it right. We're almost out of time, so I think we'll try to answer this here real quick.
The quick thing I was aiming at is there some quick way to make sure that you don't have a lossy codec, lossy STL? Just look at the RF coming out to make sure you're not creating a problem.
The best way to do that is just make sure you're not using them. So, yeah, so that's the best answer. You can ask me more after this because I'm at zero now, so... thanks a lot for showing up. I'll be around. You can ask questions then. So, thank you very much.